irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
Friends, is Time is Time by a band called Sundown from Seattle, Tacoma, Washington. And of course, your wonderful host wrote the music and the lyric, and that was my band, Sundown. Okay, you are listening to LA Talk Radio. I am your host. This is the Writer's Block, and we are on the air in all 50 states worldwide, geographically speaking. Of course, there may be some places in Russia that won't carry us because, of course, they're Russians. But hey, there's Bobby Jean Bell sitting in her little studio in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And of course, my business partner, good friend, Richard Polinelli, is sitting in his little office in Fruta, Colorado. Hey, guys.
Hey. We may have some thunder. I don't know. You may hear some thunder now and again. We've got our New Mexico cocktail hour storm, I think, on the way.
Cocktail hours. Oh,
well,
my God.
It seemed to happen.
There was something I was missing tonight.
Yeah. New Mexico has the monsoon season, and we caught a little bit of it last night here. We're hoping we don't get it, but we've got stuff in the area as well.
Yeah. Well, it's coming our way Saturday and Sunday. We could use it. Although our sprinkler systems do run off the irrigation runoff water. So it costs us nothing to water our lawn, which is great. I mean, California, of course, it was, you know, $600 to water your lawn. And here it's like free. It's free.
until somebody goes and changes the pump. And then the system loses pressure, and 4 days later, you still can't water your yard.
We had that problem already last year or year before. So, yeah, we're good. Hey, we got a great guest tonight, guys. This is her first visit to the Writer's Block. And Bobby, because Richard and I kind of cut you out last week, we're gonna let you take the lead on this one. Not completely, but more than we have been. And we don't do that on purpose, trust me. Well, Richard does. I don't. No, Richard doesn't either. We have a great guest tonight. She is a USA Today bestseller. And as I explained to her before we went on the air, we've had lots of New York Times bestsellers. We have had very few USA Today bestsellers, and she is, of course, one. She's The Widower's Wife. She came out in August of 2016. Lies She Told in September 17. Dark Turns, One Little Secret in 2019, and award-winning journalist and former television producer. Her articles have appeared in Business Week, the Boston Globe, the Record newspaper, and on many, many websites. She is a member of the Authors Guild, Sisters in Crime, and Crime Writers in Color. She is a graduate of Princeton University and lives in New Jersey with her husband, two young daughters, and a sometimes good dog. Good dog. I have a good dog. Please welcome to the Writer's Block, Ms. Kate Holohan. Kate?
Oh, thank you guys so much for having me. I'm so excited to be on.
It is absolutely our pleasure. And tonight, of course, we'll be talking about your newest book, Her Three Lives, which came out in April.
Yes.
And how is it doing? Can you kind of give us an idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's doing okay. April was a little bit difficult because a lot of the bookstores were still closed. So it meant all the events were virtual. Yeah. So, you know, you kind of lose something there because you lose that face-to-face contact, and you lose also when you have book events, the bookstore putting in a big order because you're there, right? But I think I'm pleased, all things considered. So
excellent. Now, before we get into the meat of your book, that's a great point you brought up because of COVID and all the bookstores closing down and, you know, not being that much brick and mortar stores available anymore to buy books, to walk in the door and buy books. How much do you think it's affected the writing or writers of this country, not only of this country, of course, because it's all over the world, but mostly here because that's where we are. And I think it affected Bobby doesn't write, but she does sell books. And I know it's got to have affected her sales somewhat. So what are your thoughts on that, if you don't mind, Kate?
Oh, yeah. I mean, clearly, right? We sell hardcover and paperback books, right? And we rely on them to be on the table of like new and notables when you walk in or, you know, in the mystery section. And hopefully you have good relationship with booksellers. And so when they see the blurbs and they see the things that Publishers Weekly and other publications have said, that then they try and hand sell your book a little bit. And that's where a lot of sales come from. So now I think during the pandemic, Amazon gained, kind of even more market share, which is a little frightening, particularly when you're published by, in my case, Grand Central Publishing, which is owned by Hachette, because, you know, they need a certain price point and they're trying to sell online, but they're also trying to do well by all of the brick and mortar stores that right. they have relationships with. And so I think, it just makes it harder because also Amazon obviously has books that come out and it gives them away free to Kindle subscribers. And they have this business model. And then your online book is kind of up against that. And if they're, if they control, 70% of the market or something,
right.
that's a high hurdle, right? Is that what you guys find?
Well, I found, and Richard and I have talked about this before, we have a little publishing company, Black Dog Publishing in Tuscany Bay Books, and we have found that Amazon will go in, and because if you publish by a different venue other than Amazon, you get to set your sale price. And you sell them for what you want. Amazon will go in and cut that sale price and say, oh, so many books by used books by other sellers. And chances are 9 times out of 10, they're not used books. They're new books, but they're selling them way under market. When it costs you an author, and I don't know what your book costs are costing you, but when you're as an author, your book costs are up to around $6 to $7 a copy. And your Amazon is selling them for $9.95. The object of making money just disappears.
I think Hachette really decides where the price point is and how long to keep that price point and when to offer sales. And so, and then they let me know, and that's all based on their formulas and market research. But I do think that one of the problems I've noticed is just Amazon is controlling these books are like, let's say, the top mystery sellers. And a bunch of those books will be books that are selling at a 99-cent price point or at a point where they're being given away for free to Kindle subscribers because they're on the Amazon publishing platform.
Right.
And so it just becomes harder to surface your book on Amazon. And then when Amazon has such a large control of the online market share, which for me in genre fiction is a lot of the readers.
Sure.
Literary books, people tend to buy hardcovers and they want them on their bookshelves. But, a lot of times, hey, my books are I come out with a new one every year and I like to think that they're fun and entertaining, but they're not necessarily intellectual furniture. And so I think that, that means I rely more on digital sales and it makes it a little bit more difficult.
And Bobby Jean, I'm sure somewhere in there, you have something to say.
I think it's a really interesting conversation. Kate, I will say that I loved this book. I was up way too late many nights. I had to get to the end and then the end just twisted me all around like, what? Congratulations on a great book. I know we're all just chatting about Amazon and we really, it's a wonderful conversation because we haven't had this kind of conversation very often as I can recall from 6 years of doing this show. I would like to just take a moment and say to our listeners, as well as to you as an author, you may or may not be aware of bookshop.org. which launched just before the pandemic started. The timing is everything. And they offer your book is there. It's on our affiliate page of bookshop.org. And after we interview tonight, the podcast link will be there with your book. The wonderful thing about what this organization does is 30% of every sale goes to a fund that will support independent booksellers, brick and mortars. And when we started our affiliate page, they were at about $100,000 raised. And as of today, they're at 15 million something and change. It changes by the hour. And their whole goal is to be another major platform to shop for books. And now they've added like brown trout calendars and they got puzzles. And I mean, it's amazing what I've seen in the last, in the last year. So as you're out looking at platforms, that might be another one for you to be aware of. And I think all your books are there. But we've just found that it's just a phenomenal resource. And for some readers, and an alternative, if they're interested in keeping their local, you can even say, I want that 30% to go to my local bookstore in my community, and you can earmark it. So we need to keep our independence alive, our independent booksellers. We just have to do everything we can for them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we used to have this great bookstore, Walmrath, in my town of Tenafly, New Jersey. And, unfortunately, they did close down, and it's awful because it was, it not only was it a great place to buy books, but it was a great place to hang out. Like you could bring the kids. They had children's book readings. They brought in adult authors sometimes. And it was a great part of the community. And it's a sad loss.
Yeah. Losing music stores and losing our bookstores, two huge cultural places, for discussion and interchange. But anyway, that we do really want to get to your book.
Yes. Let's take a brief break, and after the break we'll get Kate to give us a little synopsis of this tome, as it is called. So right now you are listening to LA Talk Radio. This, of course, is the Writer's Block, and we will be right back with you right after this brief word from LA Talk Radio.
Jim Christina here for LA Talk Radio. And if you've ever thought that you could be a radio host, well, now is certainly your opportunity. Go to www.latalkradio.com, find the link that says Be a Host, and follow the instructions. Everybody's got something to say. And if you've got a show that you think needs to be heard, how about you link up with us? Because we've got 50-minute shows available every day of the week, plus Sundays. So how about giving us a try? That's latalkradio.com. And listen every Thursday, 6 p.m. Pacific, for The Writer's Block, right here on LA Talk Radio.
And we are back with our guest tonight, Ms. Kate Holohan, and of course, Bobby Jean Bell and Richard Polinelli. And we'll be talking very briefly right now about her new book, Her Three Lives. And Kate, if you wouldn't mind giving our audience a little taste of what this book is about.
Oh, sure. So the book, it starts off where there's a man, Greg Hamlin, who he's 52 and kind of embarking upon the second act of his life. He married a long time, divorced, has adult children, has adult children. And he met Jade Thompson, who is 33, obviously a bit younger than him, and they and she's pregnant, and they're going to get married. And as they start this second act, there's a home invasion during which Greg is hit over the head with a crowbar and suffers a traumatic brain injury. And so he outfits his whole home with all of these cameras that so many of us have, these Nest cams and Ring doorbells and, Google assistants, because he's trying to keep his home safe. And he becomes glued to these camera feeds and watching, first inadvertently spying on his fiance, and then more deliberately spying on her as he begins to wonder whether she had anything to do with the break-in that nearly cost him his life.
For paranoia.
Yes.
Paranoia actually runs through this book.
Well, I think, you know, what I was attracted to about the idea came actually from my own life with my kids, where I have these cameras that I've had since they were little, you know, and they were kind of, we had these Nest cams, and we would, you know, monitor them to make sure that if they woke up in the middle of the night, they didn't, you know, take a tumble down the stairs or whatever. But I just, we kind of kept them, right? It just became part of the furniture of the house. And then when they would get into arguments, because now they're like 9 and 11, I would find myself saying things like, well, you know, I can go to the tape. Like, just what do you, I can see who did it first. And then I thought, oh my goodness, that has to be psychologically damaging. And so then, because I write psychological thrillers, I thought, well, you know, what, how psychologically damaging would it be? And what does it mean to kind of interpret all this information through screens like that? And I tried to find two characters that I thought would be particularly impacted by it and put them in that scenario. And then, you know, that's really where the story came from.
Yeah. You know, with cameras everywhere, it's like you lose the wonderful kid thing of, well, Bobby did it. No, I didn't. You did. No, Jimmy did it. No, Jimmy didn't do it. Jimmy wasn't even here. No, Bobby did it. No. Bill did it. Well, Bill, who's Bill? You know, you lose that little, that recourse with your kids, that, you know, that's part of life. If you look at the
also,
camera,
I mean,
I saw you do it. Fess up.
It is true. I think you also, you know, there's a certain amount of privacy that even kids should expect in their own home, right? And arguably, by having these devices on that we kind of initially installed, you know, for their physical protection to make sure no one falls down the stairs, you know, now we're kind of violating that that privacy. And maybe they're kids that are just growing up without an expectation of any privacy, which I think is somewhat true. But I like to kind of look into, well, what does that mean for us, and how can we navigate life without feeling like we have a public, a private, and then even an internal secret space?
Right.
You know,
right.
And so that's kind of where some of the drama comes from.
Go ahead, Richard.
No, I was to say, you even expanded on it to, you know, you're bringing in a drone. You've got somebody being followed by a drone camera. You've got people hacking into cell phone cameras, hacking into a house security system to see what's going on. So there is that added element of a loss of privacy. You've got these things in for your security, but at the same time, it opens a window for people from the outside that maybe you don't want them looking in. So that was a nice theme throughout the book, is how using these cameras impacts us in ways we may or may not want.
Right. And I think also how easy it is to hack into it, right? Because these weren't like super hackers that are like figuring out the code or whatever. This is like somebody gleaning your password because maybe they know you well enough to do that, right? I think privacy is relation. And it's funny because I think sometimes the people that we most care about knowing all of our business are the people close to us. Right. That privacy is relational. You don't necessarily want your husband listening in when you're complaining to your girlfriend about the fact that he doesn't clean up after himself. Right. Nor would, you know, and so, but that's, so it's kind of the people that can easily figure out the passwords that then can use these devices to maybe see somebody in all these different lights that, you know, arguably you shouldn't, even in a marriage, that there should be, you know, private conversations where somebody is, hey, just over wine talking to their girlfriends and they're, you know, having a little bit of a moaning session, you know, and it's not really meant to like become a big thing. And same thing for the other half of that relationship, right? And so I thought I have my own like love-hate relationship with a lot of these devices. I have, you know, one other story that kind of fueled this book was, once I was in a bar and I'm trying to meet my husband and we just couldn't find each other. It was really crowded. We were meeting after work. And so I have a Find My iPhone app on my phone, and he set off the alarm so he could trace the sound and find me. But I had this moment of going, oh geez, that's really uncomfortable, right? That he's like being able to track me on my phone. And I mean, I wanted to find him, so it was expedient, but it also kind of had this factor of, ugh, you know, don't know if I intended that, you know, and so.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, Bob.
This is a thriller. And of course, thrillers are also mysteries. And one of the things about this, a thriller, of course, is everybody could be the villain. And of course, we don't want to do any reveal, but I thought it was masterful writing that you kept us on the edge of our seat. When it comes to talking about the cameras, as a reader, I could imagine, I could see almost like I was watching the scenes with Greg looking at the screens, almost like I was watching an episode of a procedural drama and could see him, you know, watching. But what you did as an author that I loved was you would use in the writing, and of course, then I wrote it down and where is it in front of me, like action, you know, activities discovered, exclamation point, you know, person discovered, exclamation point. And it's like it was jarring every time you did that. I felt, you know, like, oh, this is how, you know, Greg is seeing these words or he's hearing it spoken. And it was very unsettling. And I thought that was really, really good writing on your part.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think it's because it comes from kind of my own anxiety where I have these devices and, you know, I'll be sitting there and all of a sudden my phone flashes and it's activity detected. Side yard camera, you know, and it's like a squirrel, but you do have this moment of going.
Yeah, but you know, that's all very unsettling. It's sort of like if you're really tuned into social media. And so every time you hear the ping sound or, you know, it's like, how do we, you need blocks of time in your life, especially if you're creative and you need those quiet moments. And here was, you know, throughout his day, he's getting these notifications. And I think, well, how does that affect us? Just if we were normal and we weren't dealing with the trauma that he was dealing with from the beginning of the book, to just constantly be alerted. Doesn't it just put us on edge?
Yeah. I think it does. I think also, you know, I think that and not only does it put it on edge, but it also makes us kind of wonder, like, well, is anything private? And like, you just need, I do think that we kind of sacrifice all of our privacy for convenience, right? And now I think we're maybe there's a bit of a backlash where we're starting to wonder, do we push it too much? And also, is it changing the way we relate to one another? Because like we see already on social media, like people say things online that they would never say to a person's face. And, you know, once there's that human element of kind of remembering that you're talking to another person, does it create a certain detachment that then can lead to, you know, bad situations? And so that's kind of one of the underlying themes of the book.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's another one, another thing you touched on, and you're mentioning social media kind of reminded me. Jade is, I guess you would call her an influencer, or she's got her own little Instagram type account where she's posting updates on what she's doing, you know, tips and whatnot as far as decor and cooking and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And one of the things the police officers brings up is that the assailant could have seen that big monster rock that was on her hand and followed her home. And that's kind of another cautionary tale of social media, is be careful what you share because it could come back to bite you.
Right. And yeah. I think we struggle with this as authors, right? Because mm-hmm. I don't know about you guys, but a lot of times in the contract, it's written that, oh, you know, when your book comes out, you're going to do X number of social media posts and you have to post.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, on my contract, I remember even seeing Pinterest. And I was like, well, what am I going to post on Pinterest? Right. But I mean, it was just like they were hitting every social media account. And I think it's a struggle sometimes to know, because you don't want to just sit there and have it be, you know, like a billboard for buy my book, because nobody will, you know, follow you then on social media. So then you end up kind of sharing things. Sometimes writers do tips about writing. Sometimes people share little things about themselves in hope to kind of give an idea of what their personality might be like. And so then what they might be bringing into the voices of their characters
And it's hard to know the line. You know, I notice sometimes that I'll put things up and then all of a sudden I realize, geez, my kid's face is in that photo, you know, and I have like, I have 6,000 quote unquote friends, of which probably I only know like, well,
three,
maybe, maybe yeah. really well, three, and maybe you could go like 100, you know? And so it's, I think that we struggle with that as authors and writers. What's our relationship with social media and how much should we be revealing, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's exactly how much social media has bastardized itself. You know, it's like, they used to have contests about how many new friends can you get on Facebook.
Right.
And at the time, I think it was, what was the other one that was like Facebook?
MySpace. Yeah.
Yeah. They used to have, you know, well, you know, I'm trying to get like 1,000 friends. Why? They're not your friends. You don't even know these people.
Right. But at the same time, it kind of opens up. And I think this is the double-edged sword with a lot of this technology, is it opens up an ability to, for example, for authors to promote our books ourselves. Right. So we don't feel like, oh, it's either we, you know, get a great review in a major publication, and if the publication doesn't decide to review us, then that's it. We're going to be in obscurity, and you know our work for a year is going to go poof. It's you have an opportunity to kind of build your own list and to reach out to people. So I think that's great about it. I think, you know, it's kind of created these new media careers, which is one of the things that Jade has in my book. Arguably, you know. 15 years ago, she would have been writing articles for like House Beautiful and, you know, home cooking, like all these magazines that you would see as you go check out in the grocery store. Right. And now a lot of those don't take freelance anymore or they take very little of it. And so the new career, if that was what you would have done at one point, is like, oh, well, you have to build a social media following and then your own little mini media company that sells advertising on your website, which you use social media to drive traffic to your website.
Right.
And so, you know, that's what she's doing. And it is this weird career where it's kind of, I think we're still uncomfortable with it. Is it a career? We look at sometimes these people that make all this money and you're going, well, but what is it though? You know?
Exactly.
And it's basically that they're like these little, like, individual media companies, you know? I think that it's redefining a lot of things. And I think we kind of always, technology redefines it first, and then we kind of have to figure out what our relationship to it is after.
Right. And on the backside of that, I mean, on the dark side of the good side, you have, you get posts from people you don't know, and they fill up your page. And you go, wait a minute, who is this person? You know, am I friends with this person? Oh, no, unfriend. you know, really, truly, if you want to know, our listening audience, if you want to know what this book is about, listen to the Eagles song, Lion Eyes. Because it pretty much follows Lion Eyes.
Speaking of websites for just a moment before we go to break, I spent some time on yours and I enjoyed your book trailer, which you had done yourself, and you were quite proud of it, and your word a day. And I don't know how many day, you know, if that's every day that you do a word a day, but I watched a couple of those and they were wonderful. So for authors out there that are looking for some ideas of something maybe you could do on your website, check out her website for blog.
They were very clever, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take this opportunity to take another real quick break. And you're listening to LA Talk Radio. We will be back with the Writer's Block right after this brief word from Creative Edge Publicity.
Hi, Jim Christina here for Creative Edge Publicity. And you know, there's a reason that authors flock to Creative Edge. Yes, it's true. And no one would believe it, but it is true. Creative Edge, the grassroots publicity firm that has stayed community-minded, is growing. And not only growing, but busting right out of their seams. With a client base of over 70 authors, 2 New York Times bestsellers, 6 USA Today bestsellers, and multiple multiple international bestsellers and award winners, Creative Edge in 4 years has become one of the mainstays in the publicity book market, offering reader-focused opportunities in all levels of media, including podcasts, radio, TV, print, and much more. When it comes to publicity, Mickey Mickelson and Creative Edge are experts in the book industry. Look him up at www.creative-edge.services. Creative Edge, it's your brand, your future.
And we are back with our guest, Kate Holohan, and of course, Bobby Jean and Richard. And we are talking about Kate's book, Her Three Lives. And right now we're going to switch gears a little bit. Okay, Bobby? And we're going to go to process, which you like talking about. I know you do. And when did you start writing, Kate? Because you go all the way back to 2014, and I'm sure it was way before that.
Yeah, well, you know, I joke. It's not really a joke. It's true. I wrote my first little book at seven, and my mom sent it into Scholastic, and it was rejected. So I got my first rejection letter then, and I just kept at it. But then I went to college and I was a journalist. I actually started writing for newspapers in high school. And then I did that for years, but I always wrote fiction on the side. And then really after I'd worked at Business Week covering technology and social media for a while, and then moved on to CNBC. And then after that, I had two kids and really couldn't do the daily breaking news schedule anymore. So I said, okay, I'm going to extend my maternity leave and really try and get one of these books off the ground. And then that's how Dark Turns happened, my first book. And then after that, I started doing it full time.
Okay. Question for you is, how many rejection letters did you get before you got your first book published?
Oh, I mean, I think I eventually just stopped counting because it was depressing. What I felt like, because I made the mistake of buying that big book of agents and just starting at A, like so many right. people do, and I was running. And it really is a bad way. Like, don't do it because, you know, it looks like A, you haven't put any thought into it, but you kind of haven't. And then two, I think it's like any other industry. If you can kind of go to a conference or where you can meet writers and other and agents sometimes at the conference, or you meet writers and then they like your work and they introduce you to their agent. That's such a better way because you kind of come recommended to actually getting an agent. And so what eventually I did was I went to a conference, the Algonquian Conference in New York City, and I met my agent there, Paula Mounier, and there was a whole bunch of us in a class, and she actually liked my work, and that's how I got my agent. And at the time, I pitched my first publisher, which was Crooked Lane Book. And Matt Martz had that up. And I pitched him there. And I was so nervous that I spoke. I already speak fast because I'm from the East Coast. And I spoke like, you know, the time was running out. And I tried to put in 5 minutes into 30 seconds. And I don't think he really caught much of a word of what I said. And at the end, he just kind of went, thank you. But I ended up selling my first book, not off of what I pitched, though. I think afterwards, then Paula went and pitched correctly and he gave my book a shot. But yeah, so that was my story.
Okay. Process questions, anybody? I have another one.
Oh, go ahead. You're on a roll.
Okay. When do you find time to write? I mean, you're a busy lady. Like myself, I try to write early in the morning, and Richard, you write pretty much all day if you can.
Pretty much.
Yeah. When do you find time to write your stuff?
Well, I really do. I think it's a holdover from journalism. I really do try to write 1,500 words a day at a minimum. And usually before COVID, I would do that. I'd drop my kids off at school and I would immediately start writing. And I would write until I picked them up at 3, and then they would have some activities usually that I dropped them off at, and I would continue to write. And then late at night, I would edit whatever I wrote during the day. COVID kind of changed that a bit, whereas now I tend to write later at night because, unfortunately, that's when I have the time. So Right now, I'm actually in the middle of editing a book that's going to come out in June. And I find that I'm doing it between the hours of like 6 and 4 a.m. in the morning, which is a little painful. But school will come back. It'll come back. so I'm just waiting for it to come back.
How did you pick the genre that you write in? I mean, not a lot of women like writing in the mystery genre, especially the genre that you picked, the murder mysteries. It's kind of unusual. How did you manage to pick that genre?
Well, I think the psychological thrillers are tend to be a lot of women. But I do, because it's funny. I think of the psychological thrillers tended to, I guess they kind of star female protagonists, and I'd always liked the Karen Slaughter and then Megan Miranda and then Gillian Flynn, and so these were authors that were writing around the time where I was coming out with my first book, and I think I was kind of like, well, so there were people there to be inspirations. And then I always like the kind of the Patricia Highsmith type of stories where you're not quite sure. Well, where there's either an anti-hero or you're not quite sure like who the hero is and who's the person you're supposed to be sympathizing with, and everybody is sympathetic to an extent and not to another extent. And because I feel like that's actually true of life, and that people have multiple fears, and that people are likable in some ways and not in others. And what kind of creates the drama is you can even have a likable person, but their flaws are exploited in a way that that then leads to them making poor choices.
Okay.
Yeah, that's how I did it.
Oh, that actually sounds perfectly reasonable, although, I went restaurants and Richard is sci-fi.
Yeah,
and we try very hard to put the authenticity into our stories as much as we possibly can. And I noticed that you did that as well, especially when it comes to the constant use of the digital devices throughout your book, the video cameras and the recording devices, and that kind of struck home. And I'm sure not only with me, but for Bobby and Richard as well. You don't really realize how much we're being watched during the day until we read your book. and then you realize, holy crap, everybody's looking.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I joke that I try to write from a place of anxiety, because if it makes me anxious, then it'll make someone else anxious. And that's kind of what you're doing with a lot of thrillers and suspense, is you're trying to kind of create that connection by being like, here's something that we both can worry about. And then you feel for the character. And at the end, hopefully you end it with some sort of catharsis that takes away some of that anxiety. And then people walk away feeling good about your book. Or you just, you leave them with thoughts about maybe how to make themselves less anxious by turning off some of these devices. So maybe that's where people end up. But,
I mean, they all come with on and off switches.
But then you lose the ability to, remotely monitor your house and to yell at your kids from another room. And, it's the convenience factor. I mean, it's a double-edged sword.
Well, how old are your daughters?
They are 9 and 11.
Oh, they're old enough to turn the cameras off now.
Oh, yeah, but it is funny.
Unless they're fire bugs.
When my little one was, she was even younger, she had this elaborate ruse once where I guess they had snuck in iPads and they were like going to watch a movie after we had put them to bed. And we noticed she walked over to the camera and like pretended to like yawn and knock it off as if she was like sleepwalking,
Funny.
Anyway, it was a red flag. She wasn't as good an actress. She's probably better now. I caught them with the loaded Disney movie ready to go on the iPad.
Yeah, like I said, my granddaughter was here today, and she knows how to work every device in my house. And, and she immediately goes to the TV clicker and wants to do Disney. Well, I'm sorry, but I'm watching the Smithsonian Channel. You're not going to take away my U-boats for Mickey Mouse. Sorry, it ain't going to happen. But, you know, the kids are so sophisticated these days.
They are. And how do you feel with all this stuff? How do you do your research? Has it changed the fact that you can just look anything up on the internet, or do you still find that you go to the same sources? How do you guys do your research?
I used to go through volumes and volumes and volumes at the library. Now I just sit here and get my ass flatter and research on Google and whatever search engine comes up. You can get as much information a lot quicker online than you can in the library.
I mean, I've even found, you know, coming from a journalism background, I love kind of first-person interviews, and so I'm always trying to find, like, oh, hey, I'm writing about a brain injury. Let me see if I can talk to a neurosurgeon, or I'm writing about, and I try that. But I've also found that it's amazing. Like, there'll be, like, a Reddit Ask Me Anything, and it'll be like, hey, I'm a funeral director, and I'm going to tell you all about my day, or I'm a brain surgeon, and I'm going to tell you all about my day. And then there'll be, like, a YouTube video, which I actually watched for this book, which I'm a little squeamish, so it's hard for me to watch, where somebody was operating on a person that had a traumatic brain injury and putting in a plate, and the whole thing is online. You can watch the surgery from, like, soup to nuts. So, I mean, it's really helped, I think, with some of the realism, because you really, you kind of, you can see it. And then, you know, you're kind of transcribing what you've actually watched yourself. It's kind of cool.
Right. Well, I mean, and you know, YouTube, you have the opportunity to watch Dr. Pimple Popper. You know, she knows everything. No. You know.
Oh, God, I can't. I could never. Yeah.
You did?
I know about it. Well, it's not just pimples; it's like cysts and like.
She's great. She just banters all the way through. It makes you very comfortable. Anyway, we're gonna take our last break here real quick, and you're listening to LA Talk Radio. You, of course, are. Be back with the Writer's Block right after this brief word from Tuscany Bay Books and Black Dog Publishing. Maybe. Hello.
Congratulations, you finally finished that book. Now what are you going to do with it? Well, as a new writer, you probably do what all new writers do, stick it in the drawer with the other six or seven. Well, why not this time do something a little different? Why not get a hold of Black Dog Publishing and our fine imprint of Tuscany Bay Books? See, we can get that book out of the drawer. We can proofread it. We can edit it. We can format it. We can publish it. We can print it. We can copyright it. And we can get it on the shelf so your friends, your neighbors, your relatives, hell, even a person you don't know or two or three might want to buy a copy. It's all what it's about. And all of this for less than the cost of your firstborn. So why not give us a shot? BlackDogPublishing.co, TuscanyBayBooks.com, your answer to getting your book published. And right now, we're probably the best at what we do in this industry. Black Dog Publishing, Tuscany Bay Books.
And we are back with Bobby Jean and Richard Polinelli, and of course our guest tonight, Kate Holdahan. All right, who's up for asking the question? Would that be you, Bobby Jean?
Oh, okay. I know, Richard, did you have a question for her? You had your hand up a little bit ago. Did you?
Richard? Tell you what, let's go with the question, because I suspect that her answer might lead right into where I wanted to go. So,
well, then why don't you ask the question? You go ahead and ask it then.
I will jump in here. Kate, there is a question that we must know the answer to from everyone who walks into our doors. Do you ever suffer from that vile disease called writer's block? And if you do, how in the world do you get rid of it?
Yeah, well, I think maybe once upon a time I did. Journalism kind of cures you of it, I think, because you just get used to, no matter what, you have a certain amount of copy due at the end of the day, or in some cases at the end of the hour, right?
Yeah.
So
what
I've learned is I just keep writing, and sometimes it's all crap and that's okay. And then the next day that gets deleted and I write something else. But I think because I kind of expect to write at least 1,500 words a day, then I'm kind of forced to just power through it. The other thing I find is that writer's block is sometimes because I don't know something well enough. So research to me is kind of always a cure for it. It's like, well, maybe I need to understand more about the setting, right? And if I can look up something or find it, then something that triggers something in my mind and I go, oh, okay, I see. That's how they're going to interact in this space. And now I know my way through, or I need to know something better about my character. So I need to like go into what their backstory is, backstory that doesn't always even make it into the book, and just try to understand what's fueling them. But I think that if you just, even if I understand 1500 words is a bit of a, luxury, because some people are working full jobs and also writing, but then, you know, whatever that, then pick a smaller word count and just make yourself do that word count, you know? And it,
yeah.
How do you guys deal with it?
Well, you and I have similar backgrounds, because before I started writing novels, I had about a 20-year career in newspapers. I was over in the sports corner though. And you couldn't get writer's block because you're out writing, you know, a game story or a feature story, and sometimes both on the same day. So you couldn't go to your boss and go, you know what, I got writer's block, I can't do anything. Because they'll go find somebody who can. So you don't have that luxury. So I think, you know, I don't remember how long you said you were in newspapers, but after 20 years, you are used to being able to sit down and produce X amount of words every day. So for me, I've never had writer's block, but I, similar to you, I get to a point where I'm not sure of what I'm writing about, and I have to stop and go do the research. And it's with science fiction, you still have to, even though you're making things up. But for me, I connected with a NASA scientist. So if I hit a science issue, I just get online, drop her a note, tell her, here's what I'm jammed up on, and she'll come back with the solution. So, you know, I think you hit on something when you said, you know, you're not really suffering from writer's block. You just haven't got it sorted out enough to move forward. And that's kind of my approach, is if I'm struggling, you know, then obviously there's something I'm not sure about. Let's go fix that. And I don't know what Jim does.
I actually will write something else. Go and possibly have thought another scene and go and write another scene and put it aside. And when it comes to the point where I feel it needs to be put in there, that's what I do. So writing another scene, getting away from what you're writing at that moment, I think helps a lot, because it gets your mind off what you're stuck on.
Yeah.
And then Kate, you have time to figure out what it is that you don't know. So you're right there, Kate. You know, sometimes you get blocked because you don't know. And you sit here and struggle with yourself. And why do that? That's ridiculous.
Yeah. So, Kate, there was one quick thing I wanted to ask you, because you coming in from journalism and me doing the same thing, I'm noticing a lot of authors that I'm meeting are people who were in newspapers or who were in journalism and have transitioned to writing books. And I'm kind of wondering, is that because the newspaper industry started contracting and started shedding writers? Is it just a natural extension for us to find some way to write?
I think for me, I started off in journalism. I kind of always wanted to be an author, but I also wanted to eat. And journalism was kind of like, you would get paid, you know, every 2 weeks you got a check. And so that was really what led me to journalism, with this idea that I would write fiction on the side. The problem is that if you spend, you know, 12 to 15 hours sometimes writing nonfiction, it's hard to kind of get the wherewithal to then go home and write more. That's fiction.
Yeah.
And so I found that even though I did that, the stuff wasn't really any good until I really said, okay, this is going to be my main focus for a little. But I also think, you know, yeah, the contraction has something to do with it. I think there are jobs in journalism. What I found is, after being at Business Week, where you were having to write sometimes 1 to 2 online articles a day and then an overarching piece for the magazine. So it was like a lot of copy that you were, an overarching piece for the magazine that week. So you had like a week to work on the magazine piece that was usually kind of an expansion, but told in a different way of probably one of the stories that you had written for the online publication during the week. And, you know, I think
there, so I think some of it's the contraction. I think maybe some of it is the desire to explore things more deeply rather than to constantly feel like you're churning copy on another subject. You know, every day there's always that joke of journalists where we take a dart and it's like, today I'm an expert in, and you throw the dart at a wall filled with, you know, every subject known to man. So I think that it's kind of a natural kind of desire to really delve into something because there's fewer and fewer opportunities to do that given the news cycle gets shorter and shorter. And people just, you know, they want to know exactly what happened with a little take on it, you know, moments after it's happened.
Right.
I think the problem is for a lot of journalists, like you could still make decent money in television, like when I moved eventually producing CNBC, but then it's not really quite writing. It's a lot of interviewing and a lot of writing stuff and writing notes for then people that are on air giving questions and doing the actual live interview.
Right.
Then if what got you into it was the actual writing, then it's hard to, you know, you need to kind of fulfill that.
Right. Right. I hate to cut you off, Kate. We are out of time.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for having me.
If you wouldn't mind, real quick, give your web address for your author's page and whatever addresses you want to give out, email and whatever.
Sure. So I can be found online at katehollahan.com. That's CateHollahan.com. And Kate Hollahan is also the handle of all my social media, which, as you know, I have a love-fear relationship with. And thank you guys just so much for having me. It was such a great conversation.
It was great having you. And thank you so much for taking the time to be with us tonight. And next week we have Stephanie Lavigne. She is her new book, Headlines, Deadlines, and Lies, is what we'll be talking about. And I believe the book, you just sent that out to everybody. So we will be back with you next Thursday, 6 p.m. Pacific. Thank you, Bobby Jean. Thank you, Richard. We don't have time to chat tonight because we are out of time. So for myself and Sam Hassan, the Writer's Block and LA Talk Radio, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next week. We are out of here.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.